This is the 26th broadcast in the series America Looks Abroad, presented by the officers and staff members of the Foreign Policy Association. This nonpartisan organization, open to all who are interested in American foreign policy, offers accurate information on current world events. In the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. Mrs. Vera Michelis Dean, authority on European affairs, will speak today in place of Mr. James F. Green, originally scheduled for this time. The fate, not only of Europe, but of the whole world, hinges on the outcome of Germany's invasion of Holland and Belgium. Mrs. Dean will discuss the question, can Hitler win the war this year? Mrs. Dean.
Good afternoon. With the invasion of Luxembourg, Holland, and Belgium, Germany, after 8 months of war, has come to grips with France and Britain. The bloody conflict now raging on the Western Front may not, as Hitler declared to his troops, decide the fate of Germany for the next 1,000 years, but on its outcome hangs the immediate fate, both of Europe and of the world. In his lightning attack on the Low Countries, Hitler has gambled Germany's entire resources of manpower and raw materials on a chance of winning the war this year, before the Allied blockade has undermined German economy. It had always been assumed by the Allies that Germany would attack Holland and Belgium only as a measure of last resort. First, because such an invasion was bound to shock public opinion in the United States. Second, because it involves large-scale expenditure of lives and essential raw materials, notably oil. And third, because such an invasion breaks the deadlock on the Western Front and enables the Allies to engage German forces in a familiar theater of war close to their own bases. The fact that Hitler struck at the Low Countries now, without waiting to consolidate the bases he had just acquired in Norway, would indicate that he feels under economic pressure to end the war as quickly as possible, regardless of cost. Germany is seeking to accomplish two principal objectives. It wants to obtain bases close to Britain, from which it could launch air raids and landing expeditions, and it wants to turn France's Maginot Line. During the last war, Germany occupied all of Belgium and established submarine bases along the Belgian coast. Today, it hopes to establish bases not only in Belgium, but also in Holland, some of whose ports, notably Rotterdam, are less than 200 miles by air from Britain. In their surprise invasion of the Low Countries, the Germans have once more displayed striking ingenuity, excellent coordination, and amazing attention to detail. The use of unorthodox methods like the landing of parachute troops behind the enemy's lines, disguised in Dutch and Allied uniforms, attempts to utilize so-called fifth columns of German residents to guide the movements of Nazi troops, mysterious references to the use of a new weapon reported to render the occupants of fortifications entirely helpless. These and other methods are intended to disrupt the morale of the Low Countries, confuse their general staffs and populations, circumvent their defenses, and break their resistance. This invasion, unlike that of Norway, did not catch Belgium and Holland unprepared. The two Low Countries were determined to preserve their neutrality, but they had taken many precautions against the danger of a sudden German thrust. Belgium has a stronger system of fortifications than in 1914, and a well-trained army which could muster 800,000 men. Holland, which has not been invaded since 1810, has a less well-trained army of 400,000 and a complicated system of water defenses. By landing parachute troops behind the Dutch and Belgian lines, the Germans hope to avoid the necessity of having to break through the fortifications and flooded areas of the Low Countries and to outflank their allies. So far as we can determine from censored news, both Belgium and Holland succeeded in withstanding the initial shock of German invasion, although the Germans have captured important positions, notably one of the Liège forts. Their determined resistance gave France and Britain sufficient time to bring men and material into positions determined in advance by their Allied general staffs. To break the resistance of their allies, the Nazis may have to subject their own forces to large-scale slaughter. This they are apparently ready to do in the hope of achieving a decisive victory. Such a victory is by no means outside the realm of possibility. But if the Nazis fail to win a quick decision now and are forced to fight a long war of positions, this would represent a Nazi defeat, because Germany does not command sufficient economic resources for a long war. If Hitler had hoped that his plans would be furthered by political confusion in France and Britain, this hope was defeated by the swift reorganization of the British and French cabinets. Mr. Chamberlain, bowing to criticisms of the Norwegian campaign in the House of Commons, resigned on Friday. Winston Churchill immediately formed a war cabinet of national union, which includes leaders of the Labour and Liberal opposition. In a less drastic reshuffle, the French Premier, Paul Reynaud, broadened his cabinet, which already included radical socialists and socialists, by adding two leaders of the right. These cabinet changes should strengthen political unity in France and Britain and permit more energetic prosecution of the war. It is thus with greatly increased morale and with grim realization of the issues at stake that the Allies are meeting Germany's direct onslaught on the West. Their chief weakness lies not in morale, nor in their preparations for land warfare, where the French army is expected to display its traditional courage and striking power, nor in their vast economic resources, now strengthened by the resources of Holland and Belgium. The chief weakness of the Allies lies in the fact, acknowledged last week by Winston Churchill, that they have not yet achieved equality with Germany, either in the number of airplanes now at their disposal, nor in the rate of airplane production. The Allies may therefore be forced to remain on the defensive. True, the question whether air power alone can prove decisive has not yet been answered in the affirmative. The German campaigns in Poland and Norway give no real clue to the situation in the Western countries, which command far better anti-aircraft defenses. But meanwhile, the fact remains that the Nazis enjoy superiority in the air, and whatever the outcome of the struggle, are in a position to wreak incalculable havoc on the Low Countries and on the Allies. The crucial necessity for the Allies of promptly increasing the number of their airplanes confronts the United States with an immediate decision of far-reaching importance. The United States is the only great industrial power outside the area of conflict which can furnish airplanes to the Allies. But even the United States has not caught up with the reported rate of German production. In 1939, the total output of our aircraft plants was 2,400 planes of all types, military and commercial. It is expected that by September of this year, the United States will produce at the rate of 800 planes a month, as compared with 1,500 planes a month in Germany. On May 1, before the invasion of the Low Countries, France and Britain had on order here approximately 3,000 military airplanes, and it is now reported that they may order 2,000 additional planes at once, bringing their total orders to 5,000. Can our aircraft factories fill these orders promptly? Estimates of the potential capacity of our aircraft industry vary widely. The most realistic estimate is that our total production will be at the rate of 10,000 planes a year by September 1940. At present, deliveries of planes already contracted for are being made at from 6 to 8 months after the contract date. It would thus appear that actual deliveries during the next 6 months, which may prove crucial for the Allies, will not run much over 3,000 planes. The Allies, however, could obtain additional planes if the War and Navy Departments agree to release planes they now have on order in our factories for the Army and Navy. This is entirely possible under a new policy which went into effect on March 25. This policy permits release of airplanes at the discretion of the War and Navy Departments, on recommendation of the Joint Aeronautical Board. Such action, unlike two other measures now under discussion in Washington, would not require authorization by Congress. The two other measures discussed in Washington are the grant of credits to the Allies, who must now pay cash for all their purchases here, and permission for American ships to carry airplanes and other war material to Allied ports. Both of these, as you know, are at present prohibited by the Neutrality Act. It is not expected that any action on these two measures could be taken until the next session of Congress. Meanwhile, the United States is confronted with grave decisions in other areas. The moment Holland was invaded, the governments of the Dutch, East, and West Indies declared war on Germany, interned German citizens, and seized German ships in their ports. The Dutch East Indies are strategic islands in the Far East, rich in tin and rubber, two essential war materials which the United States is now seeking to stock up. In April, in answer to a Japanese trial balloon regarding the future of these islands should Holland be invaded, Secretary Hull issued a strong warning that the United States favors maintenance of the status quo in the Dutch East Indies. Apparently, to reinforce this warning, Washington announced last week that our fleet will remain in the Pacific, probably based on Hawaii. The showdown in Europe now raises the question whether the small naval forces we maintain in the Atlantic will have to be strengthened in the near future. This would tend to reduce our strength in the Pacific and make more hazardous the use of our fleet in Far Eastern waters, should Japan choose this moment to make a thrust at the Dutch East Indies. Mr. Hull has also indicated that this country is consulting other American republics regarding possible repercussions of Holland's invasion on the status of its possessions in this hemisphere, the most important of which are Curaçao and Dutch Guiana. The issue here is that if Germany succeeds in conquering Holland, it may lay claim to Dutch possessions in this hemisphere. Allied troops have already landed in the Dutch West Indies islands of Curaçao and Aruba, which are rich in oil and lie 750 miles from the Panama Canal. And the United States has declared it does not regard this action as infringement of the Monroe Doctrine. The various problems already raised for the United States by Germany's onslaught in the West reveal the fallacy of thinking that this country, merely by proclaiming its neutrality, can insulate itself against the effects of war in Europe. There is room for legitimate difference of opinion as to the course this country should pursue under the circumstances, but it would be a dangerous self-deception to believe that it makes no difference to the United States who wins the war in Europe. It does make a fundamental difference to us whether their allies, whatever their past mistakes, remain in control of Europe's Atlantic seaboard, or succumb to the rule of Nazi Germany, which plans domination not only of Europe, but of the world. Here, as in all contingencies of life, there is a choice to be made, a decision to be reached, and it must be hoped that discussion of our future course will be unmarred by considerations of party politics. Our indignation against Germany's invasion of the Low Countries should not blind us to the fact that after the First World War, Germany had certain legitimate grievances, which, if satisfied before Hitler's rise to power, might not have assumed the monstrous form they are taking today. But neither should our attempt at objectivity blind us to the fact that the issues at stake in Europe concern us as much as they concerned those neutrals of yesterday, Norway, Belgium, and Holland. Their fate demonstrates that neither neutrality nor pacifism is a safeguard against the kind of ruthless war to which the Nazis, for the misfortune of both Germany and the world, have devoted the great talents of the German people. The future of Europe, and with it of the world, is so dark today that it requires the utmost fortitude, the utmost faith in a Western way of life, to face the decisions which lie ahead of us. This fortitude we must summon, this faith we must maintain, if we in turn are not to be undermined from within by the kind of disintegrating defeatism which in so many European countries has proved Hitler's most effective ally.
Mrs. Vera Michelis Dean, Director of the Research Department of the Foreign Policy Association, was today's speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. Mrs. Dean was the speaker today in place of Mr. James F. Green, who had originally been scheduled for this time, but who was unable to appear. If you would like a free copy of this talk, send your request to the Foreign Policy Association at number 8, West 40th Street, New York City. Number 8, West 40th Street, New York City, the Foreign Policy Association. And we invite you to tune in next Sunday to hear another speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. This is the National Broadcasting Company.